you got to read 19 clearly and look at point number 20. Point number 19 does not say that the United States is committed to a Palestinian state. The language is conditional and it focuses on what is a Palestinian aspiration. Point 20 is the key point. It says that there is no political horizon established, and what we have to do is have dialogue to figure out what the political horizon is. The political horizon is the end game. It's what the final political solution is. And the document says that we have no final solution. There's no Palestinian state as the ultimate goal. And you want to understand that the Israelis went over these 20 points with a fine-tooth comb. Ron Derner, who is Netanyahu's principal advisor on these matters, met twice on the Thursday before the Monday and on the Sunday before the Monday when Trump issued this plan. And they carefully crafted the language to make sure it doesn't reflect the argument that we're going to end up with a Palestinian state. This plan that you're looking at is not simply Donald Trump's plan. It's an Israeli-American plan. And there's no language in there that can be read to say that you're going to end up with a Palestinian state. And of course, when you listen to the Israelis talk, there's no way there's going to be a Palestinian state. I mean, look, what's happening here? We're talking about a Palestinian state. We're talking about a country where that's run by genocidal monsters who've been conducting a genocide for 2 years and whose principal goal is to drive the Palestinians out of Gaza. They don't want a two-state solution. They want a greater Israel that has no Palestinians in its midst. The idea that, you know, Trump is going to get a two-state solution is delusional.
So do you think that it's, because it does say that, you know, a valid pathway to that two-state, to a Palestinian state, is that just to sop to all those 156 countries out there, or to give political cover that, hey, well, we're trying, even though in practice, because of point number 20, there's basically no chance that it will ever exist.
But read what it says in 19 again. Just read it. I can't see very clearly.
Okay. Yeah, it says, while Gaza redevelopment advances and when the PA reform program is faithfully carried out, the conditions may finally be in place.
Did you hear that word? May.
Yes. The conditions may finally be in place for a credible pathway to Palestinian self-determination and statehood. So there's words in there that somebody who wants a two-state solution will see that. And then there's also the words that you pointed out that may finally be, that give an out to not accomplishing it.
Yeah. I mean,
my question is, is this just a sop to the people who want to focus on the word statehood and say, yeah, that's where it's going, and they can believe it because they want to, and not pay attention to the other words?
Yes, exactly. That's what it is. This is carefully crafted language, right? But the fact is, the Israelis have made it unequivocally clear that there's not going to be a Palestinian state. And when you look at public opinion polls inside of Israel, there's no interest in giving the Palestinians a state. And after what's happened over the past 2 years, do you really think that you could create a two-state solution at this juncture? I don't think so. I mean, the level of hatred and distrust on both sides is just enormous. And again, if you go to the 20th point where they talk about what is the political horizon, I mean, just, we should read point number 20.
Yeah, the United States will establish a dialogue between Israel and the Palestinians to agree on a political horizon for peaceful and prosperous coexistence.
Right. Why are they establishing a dialogue? Because the two sides don't agree. Do you think they're going to have a meaningful dialogue? Right. The Israelis have never agreed in any meaningful way to a two-state solution. They were, you know, coming closer and closer to that in the 1990s. But by the time the Camp David negotiations ended in 2000, it was all over with for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, and especially because Netanyahu's been in charge for much of that time in between. He has been staunchly against it. So real quick, before we pivot over to one more topic here, what then does that mean long term for this? If the Palestinians' aspirations are never going to be met, what's going to happen after this, when this war comes to an end?
more horrible things are going to happen to the Palestinians. Just look at what's happening on the West Bank. I mean, we're talking about Gaza, right? There were 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza before the genocide started. And at the same time, there were 3.2 million Palestinians in the West Bank. Look at what they're doing on the West Bank. It's horrendous, right? They're trying to ethnically cleanse the West Bank as well. They want to drive the 3.2 million Palestinians on the West Bank out every bit as much as they want to drive the Palestinians in Gaza out. They want a greater Israel that's Palestinian free. That's what's going on here. And they're willing to create or execute a genocide in Gaza to achieve this. Just look at that footage. Look at what they've done in Gaza. It's just truly remarkable.
In the worst way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it violates everything we're supposed to stand for as a liberal democracy. And again, as I said before, the monsters who executed this genocide are still in power.
Right. And unfortunately, that may not be the end of the target list. I want to, in the remainder of the time that we have here, I want to pivot to one of the other things that Trump's actually said on a Fox News last night. One of the things that he says helped come to get this agreement was the attack against Iran back in June.
So Gaza, we believe, is going to be a much safer place, and it's going to be a place that reconstructs, and other countries in the area will help it reconstruct because they have tremendous amounts of wealth and they want to see that happen. And we'll be involved in helping them make it successful and helping it stay peaceful. But I think it's going to be peaceful. I think, again, the Iran situation was very important doing what we had to do, which was, again, 22 years. It was planned to be done, and no other president wanted to do it or whatever, for whatever reason, but they didn't do it. And having that was very important.
What do you make of Trump making a point of saying out loud that the attack on Iran that the United States led and that Israel participated in was responsible for achieving this milestone here?
Well, let me make one other point before I answer that question. If you listen to President Trump, not just in that announcement, but in a number of other things he said in recent days, he is really committing himself publicly to peace in Gaza. It's not going to be easy for the Israelis to get around that and to restart the genocide. I'm not saying they can't do it. I'd never underestimate the Israelis' ability to manipulate Trump. But Trump is really publicly committed to peace in Gaza. And I think the Palestinians, and here we're talking about Hamas mainly, I think they've figured out that they have to hitch their wagon to Trump and hope that Trump can sort of lead them out of the wilderness. So it'd be very interesting to see how this plays out, because Trump, again, is publicly committed to creating peace in Gaza. With regard to Iran, the logic that explains how Iran led to this agreement in Gaza escapes me. Do you understand what it is?
I don't. And there was no explicit connection made other than just the claim of it. He had another, which I won't get into here, but he also made a claim that tariffs were apparently instrumental in getting the message across to some. I'm not sure how that worked out other than to say he wants to validate the things that he's been doing and say, here's some production. But he also brought up Iran this morning at a cabinet meeting he had. He was asked about Iran, and here's what he had to say then.
Iran wants to work on peace now. They've informed us, and they've acknowledged that they are totally in favor of this deal. They think it's a great thing. So we appreciate that, and we'll work with Iran. As you know, we have major sanctions on Iran and lots of other things. We'd like to see them be able to rebuild their country, too. But they can't have a nuclear weapon.
So he keeps going back to that they can't have a nuclear weapon. Well, there's lots of news out here right now that Iran is strongly rebuilding its air defenses and continuing to advance its missile production. There are those in Israel who are warning this. This party chairman, Avigdor Lieberman, on yesterday, doubled down on his controversial warning of a potential Iranian attack, telling national broadcaster Khan that the Iranians are determined to take revenge and that the people should remain in close proximity to protected spaces. We are certain that regardless of the negotiations over both the Iranian nuclear deal, and apparently he may also have in mind this stuff with the Hamas, the Iranians are determined to take revenge. What do you make of that?
I see no evidence of that. And from a commonsensical point of view, I can't imagine the Iranians attacking Israel or the United States. It would just make no sense at all. As I've watched the Iranians over the past few years, they're doing everything they can to avoid a conflict with Israel and the United States. It's the Israelis who are in the driver's seat when it comes to causing war between Iran and Israel, or Iran on one side and Israel and the United States on the other. I don't know what Lieberman is talking about. I would note, though, President Trump's comments are very interesting. And I say that because I think when you look carefully at the balance of power between Israel on one side and Iran on the other, the idea that Israel can just go in there and slam Iran and win another great victory is not in line with facts and logic. I think in terms of the first war, and here we're talking about the 12-day war in June, even though the United States participated for one day, that was on June 22nd, as you remember, I don't think Israel won a victory in that war. As I said before, they did not destroy the nuclear enrichment capability of Iran. Iran is rebuilding, and it's going to have a nuclear enrichment capability for as far as the eye can see. They didn't decapitate the regime. They didn't break the country up into parts. And if anything, they caused more cohesion between the government and the people than existed before the attack started on June 13th. So they failed. And furthermore, as you well know, Danny, the Iranian ballistic missiles and cruise missiles really began to have an effect on Israel. They were hammering Israel when the conflict ended. And there's all sorts of evidence that the Israelis asked Trump to shut the war down because the Israelis were running out of defensive missiles.
Right. And one of the key statistics that came out toward the end of that was the revelation that the Iranians started learning as the war went on and how to make the attacks, and the percentage of missiles getting through was increasing on the Iranian side. And I think that's what led Israel to say, oh, smokes, we need to get this shut off.
Yeah. Well, as you know better than I do, militaries learn in the conduct of a war. You've seen this with the Russians and with the Ukrainians as well. You right. get quite sophisticated because your life is on the line. So the Iranians got smarter, as you would expect. And the second point I would make is when I was, you know, in the Air Force, I worked in research and development and worked for a period on ballistic missiles, things like Minuteman and MX. And my sense is that attacking missiles always defeat defending missiles. That the idea that you can build up a successful missile defense is a pipe dream. It may work somewhat in the beginning, but eventually the offender overwhelms the defender. There are just so many ways. When people talk about the United States building ballistic missile defenses against Russia, I think if I'm a Russian, I want to encourage them to build a big missile defense system, spend as much money on that system as possible, because it'll be throwing money down a rat hole, because I can easily build the ballistic missile force, especially with a lot of decoys, that can just overwhelm that system. So I think the problem that the Israelis face is that they cannot procure a missile defense system that would allow them to prevail in a war in which the Iranians were throwing large numbers of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and drones at them. And I think that's what you saw in the 12-day war. At first, the Israelis did quite well, but then the Iranians learned, and then the Israelis began to run out of defensive missiles. This is what happens. And by the way, those defensive missiles are incredibly expensive. And you can build decoys very cheaply, which cause all sorts of problems for the defenses. So all this is to say, I'm not sure the Israelis are going to attack Iran in the fall. If I had to bet, I would bet they will. But
yeah, so despite any kind of evidence or any kind of rational, they still might do it anyway. But yeah. Well, that leads me into the second part of that question is from I don't know if psychological is the right word, but from a political perspective, they have painted Iran as this, you know, the head of the octopus and these tentacles and all this. You mentioned earlier that they will have to view, if they're being honest anyway, everything that's happened in the last 2 years in terms of Hamas as a disaster for Israel. They didn't accomplish hardly any of their objectives at all, and they've now created new negatives that they didn't have before. But then you look at the situation with Iran. Now that we see that Israel's more vulnerable to missile attack, and they can't defend against that, but they have set that up as the quin sanon, so to speak, that, you know, that's what it's all about, getting Iran. And can they just go, okay, all right, forget it, we'll just live with Iran now? Do you see that happening?
No. And by the way, the issue here, despite all this talk about Iran racing to get a bomb, that was not the issue. The problem was that Iran had a significant nuclear enrichment capability. You remember, they were enriching up to 60%, not yeah. far away from 90%. And in fact, it's a hop, skip, and a jump from 60% to 90%. That spooked the Israelis. The Israelis wanted to do away with their enrichment capability. The argument for not attacking Iran was that you had IAEA inspectors in there, and we could keep an eye on what the Iranians were doing. There are no more IAEA inspectors in there as a result of the 12-day war and what the Europeans and the Americans have done since the 12-day war. So we're now in a situation where we're blind as to what what Iran is actually doing on the nuclear front. And from Israel's point of view, this is a disaster. Furthermore, almost everybody agrees that the 12-day war gave the Iranians a greater incentive to acquire a nuclear deterrent. That's not to say they will acquire a nuclear deterrent, but the war gave them a greater incentive to acquire one. You don't have your eyes anymore to see what they're doing because the IAEA is no longer there. So they're much worse off vis-a-vis Iran than they were before October 12th. And by the way, Hezbollah and Hamas are both alive. They inflicted limited defeats on both of them, but they're both alive. And as I like to say, when people say, well, they were decapitated. Yeah, they were decapitated, but then they grew back new heads.
Right. So,
and then you could decapitate them again and they'll grow back new heads. And the same thing is true with Iran. So that doesn't buy you anything. And furthermore, and this is terribly important in my opinion, the Israelis are more dependent on the Americans than they have ever been. There was a recent report that was just issued that says that we, the Americans, have given the Israelis over $31 billion, $31 billion in assistance since October 7th, 2023, over the past 2 years, $31 billion. This is truly stunning. By the way, approximately $21 billion was in direct economic and military assistance. And the other 10 was the money that we spent, fighting wars on Israel's behalf. Just amazing amount of money. And as you know, you and I have talked about this on many occasions. There's no way they could have executed this genocide.
Yeah.
And got around the Middle East bombing every country in sight without American assistance. They just absolutely need us.
Yeah, and then the question is, you know, what's going to happen after this? Because as you said, Trump has put his credibility. I mean, he really wants, especially if he gets that Nobel Peace Prize tomorrow. We'll see if that happens. I'm seeing some of our commentators here in our group that's watching there. There, a lot of them will be rolling their eyes or dying if he gets it, but he may. But he's invested himself in this. And if then if Israel whether that's, you know, in the fall, if they try anything against Iran or if they go back into the Gaza Strip, it's just going to be harder because there's already a lot of antagonism around the world against Israel, much higher than it was 2 years ago. And it's probably going to be placated some by if this ceasefire sticks. But if you then flame that back up, I think that the antagonism could go higher on the post side of that. So there's some real risk, I think, for Israel.
Yeah, yeah. I think, by the way, just with regard to Trump, I think he is getting, well, let me make 2 points. One is just on the Nobel Prize. I do not think he'll get the Nobel Prize tomorrow simply because the decision was made on who would get the prize before these new events in Gaza. And I think, if anything, he will aim to get the prize next year. And that will give him a powerful incentive over the course of the next 12 months to go to enormous lengths to be a peacemaker, both with regard to Iran and with regard to Gaza. You know, those comments that you played of him talking about Iran, he was actually talking in a very moderate way, as if he were interested in reaching some sort of agreement with the Iranians, much like he's pushing forward this peace proposal or ceasefire in Gaza. But the other point I wanted to make to you, Danny, is I think what's happening in Trump's case is that his base has turned on the Israelis in very important ways. Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson are two really key players in this regard. And Charlie Kirk, of course, was moving in that direction. And I think Trump is feeling the heat from below, from his base, from the body politic more generally in the United States. I mean, he reads public opinion polls. And furthermore, I find it hard to believe that he's not getting a lot of pressure from around the world, that leaders around the world are not telling him that this just has to stop, because the concern with ending this genocide is just so widespread and so deep all around the world. I believe it just has to percolate into the White House, and it has to have an effect on Trump. So I think this is really sort of what's causing him to push hard now to get some sort of ceasefire.
Well, listen, I like your idea about don't give him the peace prize tomorrow, but wait till another year. Maybe we can toss in ending the Russia-Ukraine war into that too, and then I'd build a public campaign for him to win it if he did all of that and kept us out of these other wars. But I guess, like always, we'll have to wait and see what happens, and can't underestimate people making dumb decisions. But we'll just be that bad as it may. But listen, thank you so much for coming on. We covered a whole lot today. Want to send people, if you don't get enough of John on our show, go back to mearsheimer.substack.com to see John's Substack, where he has all kinds of stuff. And you can keep up to date where he puts all kinds of stuff on there, and interviews and videos as well. So thank you very much for coming on, John. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure as always, Danny.
And we will see you guys next on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Thank you very much. See you later.